Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning. Welcome to the premiere show of the Atlanta Legal Experts radio show. I'm your host, Emily Rowell, with Crown Office Suites. We also have Rich Casanova with Buckhead Business Radio X in the background here, working as the producer and engineer today. Our special guest of our show today are Amanda Farahani with Barrett and Farahani and Valentia Alleen with the Alleen Law Group. So we're going to start with you, Amanda. I'm going to just give a quick little bio here. Amanda Farahani is the managing partner at the Atlanta law firm of Barrett and Farahani, LLP, representing individuals in employment, libel, overtime, and sexual harassment litigation. Excuse me. Through her practice, she is dedicated to pursuing civil justice for employees, as well as providing consultation and support to management employees. In addition, she is an adjunct faculty member of Emory Law School, teaching advanced trial advocacy. Prior to beginning her practice, she clerked for the Honorable John H. Ruffin, Jr. at the Georgia Court of Appeals. Known as an attorney who only takes serious and important cases, Amanda has proven this by achieving the highest verdict in a Family and Medical Leave Act case in the nation for her client and the largest libel verdict in Georgia. Amanda has also been recognized by her peers as a super lawyer, an award which acknowledges the top lawyers in Georgia as chosen by Georgia super lawyers and through the independent research of law and politics. She has been elected to the executive board of the National Employment Lawyers Association, Georgia chapter, and is on the executive board of the Atlanta Bar Association's labor and employment section. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, Emily.
I have a great questions here for you. What are the most common employment issues that you see?
Well, we see a lot of employment issues. Obviously, almost everyone is either an employee or an employer. So one of the most common that we're seeing in the workplace is people calling just because of problems with their manager, which unfortunately doesn't lead to the ability to bring a lawsuit. But we do also see other kinds of cases. A lot of sexual harassment, a lot of discrimination still goes on in the workplace. And then what most people don't realize is that they're probably being paid wrong and are entitled to overtime.
Gotcha. Yeah. We know that Georgia is an at-will state. What does that mean exactly?
Well, at-will means that you are employed at will, meaning that you can quit for any reason or you can be fired for any reason. But there are exceptions to that. So although people think, well, it's at will, I can't do anything, if one of the other laws are violated, then that actually gets rid of the at-will issues and you still have the ability to bring a claim.
So if there's actually a contract in place, if one of those rules in the contract was broken, then the at-will thing is actually...
Right. Well, at-will is the opposite of a contract.
Right.
So if you have a contract, it's, hey, you're employed here for a term, 2 years, whatever it might be. Otherwise, you are at will. You can quit or be fired for no reason. But, for example, if somebody sexually harasses you and you refuse that and you get fired, that's an illegal reason. So
right.
At-will goes away.
Gotcha. Thank you. What about sexual harassment, since you mentioned that? How does someone prove it when it is just a he said, she said type of issue?
Well, it's interesting. We've had he said, she said kind of issues for a really long time. And today's day and age, what we're seeing a lot more of are people coming in with tape recordings, video recordings, text
wow.
messages, text pictures. So there's a lot less of the he said, she said. And mm-hmm. and what most people don't realize is as long as you know that you're taping someone, you're allowed to do that.
Right.
So in today's day and age, anyone who's got an iPhone or a telephone can walk in. And if they're being harassed by their boss, they can just take that and record it and bring it in and you know, have the actual evidence.
Right.
But even if they don't, it's still a matter of credibility. And so when you've got somebody who's harassing someone, what we have found is even if our client doesn't know about it, we can usually find a history of mm-hmm. sexual harassment that we can point towards that harasser.
Gotcha. Gotcha. That's some good advice, too, for somebody who wouldn't think about that otherwise, to bring in a recorder or something like that
yeah,
if they feel they're being harassed.
It's amazing what people will say.
Yeah, I'm sure. What should an employee do if they feel like they are being discriminated against or harassed besides recording it? What should they do otherwise?
Well, that's a great question. If someone feels like they're being discriminated against, they are protected in the workplace if they make a complaint. Now, mm-hmm. most people are scared that if they make a complaint of harassment or discrimination that they're going to be fired. So what they need to do, though, in order to ensure that, one, hopefully it stops, is to go to their human resource or look at their employee handbook and see who's in that book that's supposed to be getting these complaints of discrimination. Mm-hmm. And then going to that person, making that complaint, ensuring that they're saying the words discrimination, and then following it up with an email or some sort of correspondence or even recording it. Mm-hmm. And at that point, if the company comes back and retaliates, then they've got a claim for the retaliation as well. But if they don't take that affirmative steps, it's a lot harder for them to show that there really was something happening.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Now, I have another question here. I'm hearing a lot from President Obama about the minimum wage and overtime laws. How are companies still violating these overtime laws?
In a multitude of ways, in fact. So it has long been thought that if you are paid on a salary basis, that you're not entitled to overtime. And mm-hmm. that's simply not true. If you are paid on a salary basis, in very narrow circumstances, you might not be entitled to overtime. And what we've seen happen as the economy has gotten worse and worse is that people are being required to work more and more than they used to. So it's mm-hmm. it's uncommon now for someone to actually work less than a 40-hour work week. So everyone knows if you're hourly, you're entitled to overtime. Mm-hmm. What people don't realize is if they're hourly, they're entitled to overtime on everything, including bonuses and commissions, not just their hourly rate. And if they're salaried, only a very, very few people aren't supposed to be getting overtime. Really, those people who are at the top of the company who benefit from the company's income.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And, okay, we already answered that one. How could someone find out whether their situation violates the employment laws?
Well, obviously, the internet is a great place to start, but you can't look at the internet as something that's going to teach you about what your law is, because every single case is a little bit different and every person's situation is different. At our firm, for example, when you call our firm, what we do is we have every single person who calls our firm speaks with an attorney. Mm-hmm. I think that's unusual for employment law in particular, so we don't charge people. If they call in typically the same day, at most within 24 hours, they're going to have a phone call with one of the attorneys who can sit down, know how to identify all the potential employment issues in their situation, and then explain what the law is to them.
Gotcha. And just a quick question for my personal, Amanda, how did you really start focusing on employment law? What was it that made you want to concentrate on that?
Well, I really feel like I got led into employment law. So I decided early in my career that I was going to just start out on my own. And I knew that I cared about discrimination and women's issues and things like that. And I really got led into it. My first case that I had a client come to me and said, hey, I've got a case that's going to trial in 2 weeks. It's a discrimination case. Will you take it? I took it on, ended up going to trial on it, had a lot of fun, learned a lot about it, and I realized that this really was a good fit for me.
That's awesome. Well, we're glad you're here, and we're glad you love what you do. That's so awesome. And why don't you tell everybody who's listening how they can get more information on you?
You can find us at justiceatwork.com, which is on our website. You can also give our office a call at 404-214-0120. That's our main number.
Thank you. Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. And then Valentia, our next guest. Good morning. Thank you for coming today. I'm going to do a little quick bio on Valentia. Valentia Aline devotes her time to bankruptcy, consumer law, and collections defense, and estate planning. Ms. Aline has focused her practice on helping people change their lives for the better. Her role as an attorney allows her to ensure her clients receive a fair and just outcome to their case. Ms. Aline works closely with her clients to guide them through the legal process, keeping them fully informed at all times, and working with them to establish an enduring financial responsibility and personal independence. Prior to practicing law and founding the Aline Law Firm, Ms. Aline worked as a marketing and business development executive in the corporate sector for 15 years. Ms. Aline received her BA from the University of Virginia, her MBA from the University of Phoenix, her JD from Loyola University Chicago School of Law, where she received special honors for her public interest work, her LLM in taxation from Northwestern University School of Law. You've done a lot.
A lot. Yes.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Why did you choose to practice bankruptcy law?
Well, I went back to, as you just referenced, law school a little bit later in life. And when I graduated about 4 or 5 years ago, we were in the heart of one of our worst recessions we've seen in this country since the Great Depression. And so for me, on a daily basis, whether it was loved ones or just people who were calling the office were facing dire straits, good people just facing hard times, being laid off for almost 2 years. Haven't seen that again since the Great Depression. And so for me, I have a passion for people who want to do the right thing, but face challenges that they just didn't anticipate. And so I decided to be a consumer advocate, and that's really what led me into the area of primarily consumer bankruptcy on the bankruptcy side and estate planning on the other side of my practice.
Gotcha. Awesome. So who are your typical clients, and what should be aware of or consider before filing a bankruptcy?
Bankruptcy touches both individuals, families, and businesses. So my client can be anyone or any entity. For me, again, my practice focuses primarily on consumer bankruptcy, so dealing with families and individuals, but also small businesses, because individuals can file what we consider Chapter 7, Chapter 11, or Chapter 13, and businesses can file a Chapter 7 or 11. So we cover the whole gamut. That the most important thing, whether you're a consumer or a business, is heading on your problem early, identifying the issues. I try to be proactive versus reactive if at all possible. So there is a bit of planning, that goes in before you decide, if bankruptcy is the smartest choice for you. And so, what I tell people, if they are going to consider bankruptcy, let's kind of look at it, evaluate the whole business picture, your financial picture, because we may be able to do direct negotiation with the creditor to keep your credit intact. If you're a business, we may be able to liquidate assets to pay off debt before you take the bankruptcy route. So we take a holistic approach, and I always look at bankruptcy as just part of the toolkit. And is that tool the right choice for you at the particular time, or are there alternatives to bankruptcy?
And you mentioned the creditors as well. Do you represent both the creditors and the debtors?
Yes. Primarily, we do represent consumers, but on the creditor side, whether it's a landlord who wants to make sure their interest is protected with a tenant from a lease perspective, or on a creditor side, it can be helping them get relief from the automatic stay so that they can obtain their property and sell it or what have you. So we do creditor work, and I think it's actually a benefit to debtors, believe it or not, because if you know what the issue is from the creditor's perspective, there is opportunity to hopefully a more cost-effective, and certainly from a creditworthiness perspective, if we can negotiate outside of the courtroom and find a happy medium between the creditor and the debtor, it saves the debtor's credit, certainly for sure, and also minimizes the litigation with the attorney's fees that come with that.
Gotcha. That's awesome. When may you file for bankruptcy protection, and what kind of relief is available?
You can file, as I previously mentioned, bankruptcy at any time. On the consumer side, again, you have choices, typically Chapter 7, 13, or 11. And a 7 is what we consider a liquidation bankruptcy, where it gives you an opportunity as a debtor or a business to get a fresh start, walk away from your debts, and get that fresh start, which is what the bankruptcy code or Congress designed the bankruptcy code for. And the great thing about Chapter 7, which a lot of people don't know, there are no limits. I've had clients who are $3 million in debt and have a Chapter 7. What we do is to determine if you can qualify without being too lawyer-like early in the morning is what we call the means test. It all boils down to what your income is compared to what the expenses are to determine which chapter an individual or a business organization can file. On a Chapter 13, we look at that as a wage earner or a restructure, because it gives you an opportunity over a 3 to 5 year period to be able to repay your debts. And so a lot of people, if they ask me a question, well, why should I do a 7 or 13? a lot of people file Chapter 13 are because they have assets that they want to protect.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so let's say you're delinquent on your home for 10 months. To file Chapter 7, if you want to keep your property, you have to be current. And you may not have that opportunity if you're 10 months behind or, you know, trying to protect some other asset that you just don't have the funds to pay. The most important thing I also wanted to point out, and I think it's important from an education perspective, is, which goes back to planning and having some foresight. It breaks my heart on at least a weekly basis. I have clients that come in and they've liquidated their IRAs or their 401ks, which are generally 100% what we call exempted from the trustee and the creditor. And so I shared to simply say, if you ultimately are going to have to file, hold on to what was designed to take care of you when you retire, because it's typically 100% exempt. And if you took that money out to pay a creditor and you still filed bankruptcy, what did you do it for? Because once that money is gone, it's very hard to replenish. Also, you may be creating new debt because you have the income tax if you do the early withdrawal, and then you have the early withrawal penalty from a 401k or IRA.
That's very important to know. Mm-hmm. Good advice. So what happens after you file for bankruptcy, and what should a filer expect?
What happens after bankruptcy, the number one question I get is, how's this going to affect my credit? And the people who are considering bankruptcy, their credit's already been damaged or tarnished, or they probably wouldn't be considering this as an option. And so I always tell people it doesn't get much worse. If anything, it gets better, because certainly, of course, your FICO score is going to be affected. There's no way that you can get around that. But so is every time you're 30 days late or 60 days late, or you have a judgment. So adding a bankruptcy doesn't diminish that drastically your credit score. But what it does do, especially if, say, if you file Chapter 7, which again is a liquidation, you're usually outside of that Chapter 7 within 90 to 120 days of filing. And so from that point, you can start to rebuild your credit. And mm-hmm. typically, it's like any other derogatory. The further you get away from it, the less impact it has on your score. So you go from being one of the least credit worthy debtor to being where you are the optimal, because you've offloaded the debt that you had prior to filing. So you certainly, I won't sugarcoat that part. You do mm-hmm. take an immediate hit, but it gives you that fresh start, and it helps you rebuild where you wouldn't have probably had that opportunity if you continue to let the circumstances that led you to file the bankruptcy just sit there.
Gotcha. Okay. So what is the best way to address a creditor that was left off the bankruptcy and the debtor has received a discharge?
That's a great question. So a lot of people don't know that once a bankruptcy discharge, you actually can open it, but you have to have it based on what we call for cause, because there's an administrative cost with reopening the case. The number one is, in bankruptcy, you have to do what we call a pre-filing and a post-filing course in order to receive your discharge. Now, if you have to take the pre-petition, because if you don't file that, you can't file the bankruptcy. Your case is going to get dismissed. But because there's time to do the post-petition course, a lot of people will take the course, and for whatever reason, the certificate never gets filed with the court, so the case gets closed and without receiving your discharge. And so that's certainly a reason to reopen the case and file the certificate. Other reasons are, you may have forgotten assets, and it's very important. What most people don't understand, there's this fear that I can't tell you everything. That's where you run into trouble. You need to tell me all the assets that you have, so mm-hmm. we can exempt them out. If we speak early enough, this is kind of where the estate planning comes in. We can legally look at transferring assets or do what we consider asset planning before you mm-hmm. even look at bankruptcy. And so if you've forgotten a creditor, to answer the last part of the question, you can certainly reopen that. The key is, as long as a delay, normally a court won't have an issue with it. And a prime example is, you had a landlord and you left the home 4 years ago, completely forgot, mm-hmm. because they never came looking for the last 2 months of rent. They filed their dispossessory. They just wanted you out of the home, but they can file for a deficiency, and they just don't collect on it, because you can collect up to 6 years after a judgment's been rendered here in the state of Georgia.
Okay.
So you just forgot about it because you never heard from them. Well, that is a valid reason for cause to open a case. As long as that delay has not caused jeopardy or harm to the creditor, normally the court won't have an issue with you reopening the case to add a creditor, because people have debts, old debts, and completely forget about them, which is fair.
Gotcha. Well, you're talking about assets. What are some of the pros and cons of asset protection?
Yeah. So asset protection, there's a difference between asset protection and fraud conveyance via fraud. If you try to transfer your home right before you file bankruptcy, that's going to be a fraudulent conveyance.
Gotcha.
Because you're trying to offset this right before you file. And it's something that can be easily traced because anything that's titled has to be recorded. So a trustee or creditor can easily see that you've done the shift. And one of the questions on the bankruptcy schedules is, have you transferred any property?
Gotcha.
So again, it's not that you can't, but it's the problem that you run into is if you don't tell me, or the court, that is, that you have transferred, and there has to be a basis for why you transfer that mm-hmm. asset. And so what I tell people is, especially if you may be someone like a person that I had that had $3 million in debt, you're a high net worth client, the estate planning kicks in if you're early enough that you can start to, for tax purposes, look at finding estate planning vehicles to legally protect your assets before you even consider having to file bankruptcy. So that's what we mean by asset protection.
Those are some really interesting points. A lot of stuff for me to learn. I really am interested in that. And I want to go back to Amanda. What led you to want to pursue your own firm?
So some silly things. To start with, though, I had grown up, my parents were both independent. My father's a physician. My mother owned businesses. And so I was always led to think that it's better to work for yourself and to develop something. But what really was the last deciding factor for me is I am just not a morning person. And having to be at work every single morning at 8 o'clock in the morning to me sounded awful. And so I started my own firm. And then since that time, we've really worked towards developing it. And we're actually now the largest plaintiff's employment firm in Atlanta.
Wow, that is awesome. Yeah, well, I'm glad you were here at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yes,
thank you
it was
for
difficult.
Making that
yes.
sacrifice. So. And we would love to have you back on, too,
thank
as
you.
A future guest as yes. well. And Valentia, I believe Amanda actually had a question or two for you, possibly.
Yeah, so we often have people who come to us, obviously they've lost their job, and so it's difficult for them to try and figure out what to do. One of the things that we've noticed, however, is that people are filing bankruptcy and not including it as one of those assets. It's a forgotten asset, I think you called it. How do you deal with that in bankruptcy?
Well, from a bankruptcy perspective, we have what we call schedules. And one of the schedules is the Statement of Financial Affairs. And it's a series of about 21 questions. And so to try to avoid that issue, again, stressing on the outset that it is important that you fully disclose, because I've only had one case, but I had a client who didn't disclose all of his assets, mm-hmm. and he did not receive a discharge, and we could not refile under a different chapter because the court deemed it as not a good faith filing.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, I can't stress enough the point of really being clear with the client. And by going through the questions, normally we avoid that issue because one of the specific questions is, you know, have you received any inheritance? Are you involved in a lawsuit? Can you be sued? Because even when you receive your discharge, the trustee can go back mm-hmm. for up to 6 months and see, maybe you settled this right after you received your discharge. That is considered an asset from the bankruptcy court's perspective. And the trustee can take that asset and use it, turn it into cash to pay creditors. So again, it's the key here is being forthright and honest. And that also goes back to being strategic because it may, as long as you're not facing, you know, a foreclosure or you're being garnished, which here in Georgia can be garnished up to 25% of your wages. From a strategic perspective, it may make sense to hold off until your lawsuit is settled, because it would be prior to filing. And if you've done something with that, whether to pay medical bills, buy a home, whatever the case may be, you have less of an issue. So there is some planning involved from that perspective. We may delay their bankruptcy to avoid that particular issue.
What about someone who's filed for bankruptcy, doesn't realize at the time they filed that they might have a claim, like an overtime claim, for example? Then they come to another lawyer. That lawyer files the overtime claim. Obviously, lawsuits take, you know, 2-3 years. How do you deal with that? And how do you make sure that those clients know what to do, or, you know, tell other lawyers what they're supposed to be doing about that?
Right. That's a little bit tougher. Mm-hmm. But normally what we do is we ask, and it's actually, not only does the attorney ask, at what we call the 341 or creditors meeting, the trustee will ask, do you anticipate or are you involved in any type of suit? Because at the time, they may legitimately not know. The key is, if they do realize they have a claim, I always say, wait until you receive your discharge, because you don't want to, or if we're going to them, again, we just simply have to go in and amend the schedules mm-hmm. before they receive their discharge. Again, just to fully disclose that. But normally, if you can, especially on a Chapter 7, because you're out in such a short time frame, a Chapter 13 is a little bit different. And so you don't want to wait 3 to 5 years to file your claim, because I'm sure your statute of limitations issues. But if you're doing a Chapter 7, for simplicity's sake, it's better just to wait until you receive your discharge and then file your claim.
And I just have one follow-up question for both of you. Amanda, I'll start with you again. What do you find the most challenging in your position?
Clients, judges, and opposing lawyers.
So everything?
No, each one of them have different challenges. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, with clients, it's difficult sometimes to explain how the court system is set up and why things take so long. And, you know, a lot of times explaining to people that in the state of Georgia, there's not a whole lot of rights that they have.
Wow.
Obviously, opposing counsel are there to try and ensure that my client loses. So that's always a difficulty. And sometimes it feels like judges are there for the same reason. And, you know, so that makes it more difficult, too.
Well, I'm sure you do a wonderful job overcoming that as well.
Thank you.
You
we
wouldn't
try.
Be as successful as you are if you didn't.
Thank you.
And then, Valentia, same question goes for you. What do you find the most challenging thing about your job?
Can I say ditto?
Absolutely.
For me, the because I'm a solo practitioner, so probably being efficient in my time mm-hmm. and being smart. I do have support staff, but I'm the only attorney in my office. And so I would say time management and really being smart about the kind of cases. And I think that's a benefit of being self-employed as well, or owning your own firm, mm-hmm. that we can choose the clients. And sometimes it's just not a good fit.
Right.
So being smart from that perspective as well gives me a little bit of extra sleep at night. So for me, it's just being smart with my time and choosing cases that make the most sense for my practice.
Gotcha. And you were very successful coming into Atlanta, starting your firm right out of school.
I was.
And becoming very successful already and after you graduated. So that's great to know. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on. And if you could tell the listeners how people can contact you.
Sure. We are online at theallenlaw.com. So www.allenlaw.com. We're also on Twitter or Facebook. And certainly we'd love to receive your call in the office at 800-611-2985.
Awesome. And for full bios, you can go to my website at ale.businessradiox.com. That's Atlanta Legal Experts. So it's ale.businessradiox.com. Again, my name is Emily Rowell. I'm with Crown Office Suites, and you can also see my website at crownofficesuites.com. Don't forget the E on the end of the crown. Thank you so much for listening. And this is Emily Rowell signing out.